All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Great Integral Awakening. My name is Craig Hamilton. I'm the founder of integralenlightenment.com, and in addition to being one of the presenters on the series, I'm also hosting the events. Claire Zammit usually does the introductions for us, but she's busy leading a workshop of her own today, so I'm going to be wearing both hats. It's great to have you all with us for part five in our series featuring Genpo Roshi on the future of Buddhism. And a special welcome to everyone who's joining us for the first time. Thanks to everyone also for all of your continued feedback on the series and on last week's dialogue with Andrew Cohen. It's been great to receive all of the emails and to see all the activity on the Facebook discussions this week. We're now up to 40 different discussion threads and about 2,000 people participating on Facebook. So if you haven't joined in yet and you want to find a community of like-minded spirits, I'm sure you'll find someone discussing something you're interested in there. And you can find a link in the email we sent you this morning that'll take you there, or you can just search on Facebook for The Great Integral Awakening. A few logistical things to let you know just before I introduce Genpo. We've been pleased so far that we haven't run into any technical glitches with the series, but some of you have reported having trouble hearing the last two presenters through your computer speakers. And we don't have any way to boost the volume during the live event, but if during this or any future presentations you do have an issue with volume, I have a couple suggestions for you. One is that you can dial in through the conference line and listen by phone, and you shouldn't have any audio problems there. The other is that after each of these live sessions, we're now going to be boosting the audio volume in an editing booth and then reposting those louder audios on integralenlightenment.com. And I'll include a link to those new louder audios in each week's email. So if you do have volume troubles, just hang out for a few days and we'll send you a link, and then you'll be able to play it on your computer and should be fine. We also want to thank our co-hosts at Integral Life and our 8 co-sponsors for all of their support. For those of you who are with us for the first time, the way these teleseminars work is that I will introduce Genpo Roshi and the day's topic, and then he and I will engage in dialogue for about an hour. After that, we'll open it up for questions from the audience, so you can interact with Genpo Roshi directly via phone or by instant message. So I'm really excited to be here with this pioneering Zen master, Genpo Roshi. His full name is Dennis Genpo Merzel Roshi, and he's the founder of the Kanzaion International Sangha. He's been abbot of Big Mind Western Zen Center, formerly known as Kanzaion Zen Center, in Salt Lake City, Utah, for about the past 22 years. He received Dharma transmission in both the Soto Zen and Rinzai Zen traditions, and he's the second Dharma successor of Taizan Maizumi Roshi, with whom he began his Zen practice way back in 1972. But he is best known as the creator of the Big Mind process, a truly original contribution to Zen, which has been central to his teaching for the past 10 years. Roshi's publications include The Eye Never Sleeps, Beyond Sanity and Madness, 24/7 Dharma, and The Path of the Human Being. His latest book is Big Mind, Big Heart, Finding Your Way. And I'm personally really looking forward to this conversation because Genpo Roshi holds a unique place in our series in that he continues to stand as a strong representative of traditional Zen practice and yet is also taking great strides to evolve his tradition in accord with contemporary psychological insights, which, as you all know, is really what we're trying to look at in this series. So with no further ado, Roshi, welcome to the Great Integral Awakening.
Well, thank you, Craig. I'm happy to be here.
Great. Well, I'll tee this up a little and then let you dive in. The big question that we're exploring in this series is how the spiritual path needs to evolve to keep up with a changing world and an evolving humanity. You know, it's been observed that today's world is radically different than the world of the Buddha or of any of the ancient sages, and also that human beings have evolved enormously in the past couple thousand years, even in the past 100 years. You know, our interiors have changed a lot. And yet, by and large, the vast majority of spiritual teachings available to us now and that are being practiced, even if they're in Western incarnations, still tend to remain rooted in ancient worldviews, tend to be just reiterations of practices that have been going on for millennia. And my impulse for creating this series came out of my sense that spiritual practice itself, that the spiritual path itself actually needs to evolve in significant ways to really meet the evolutionary needs of modern humans, to meet the challenges of a new world that we live in. And here you are, someone who's deeply steeped in your tradition, done, you know, decades of traditional Zen practice, and yet you've also pioneered a radical new approach to Zen, which you call Big Mind. So I'm guessing you must have been responding to a similar sense of this notion that tradition, for all of its wisdom, could in some way be improved on, at least in a practice sense. Can you just tell us a little bit about what inspired you to improve on your time-tested ancient tradition?
Sure. And I do want to say that you and I are on the same page on this, that all the way back in, I think it was 72 or 73, I had the realization that, like when Buddhism came to China from India 500 AD after 1,000 years, and Buddhism then married Taoism, we got what we now know as Zen, the Zen tradition. And I felt like in the West, it was going to be a marriage between the Western philosophy and psychology and science, and religion, of course, with the Zen Buddhism that has come over from Japan, China, Korea, Vietnam, and so on. And I had started my own Zen, practice in psychotherapy, Gestalt therapy, back in the late 60s. And then when I had my first awakening in 71, it put me on this path, the Zen path, but I knew right away that it was going to be a marriage of these two. And as you mentioned, you know, I trained in the traditional practice since 1972 when I began my study with Taizan Maizumi Roshi in Los Angeles. And what we were seeing in those days, particularly Bernie Glassman Roshi and myself, we did a lot of talks on this together, discussions, that it was going to be really important that we, what we called, swallow the whole fish. In other words, we totally surrendered ourselves to the tradition. The tradition that was out of a male monastic model in Japan, and we knew we had to just throw ourselves into it completely, swallow the whole fish, and then at some point the rest of our life we would be what we called spitting out the bones. In other words, we'd be refining what is really relevant in the West, what is irrelevant, what we keep and what we don't need in the tradition. So really, with the death of my teacher, our teacher, in 95, he died in May of 95, it's been a process for me of the beginning of spitting out some of the bones and finding what the marriage looks like, the integration of East and West. And what I saw at some point, probably in the early 2000s, was that how could we imagine that the Eastern wisdom, the Eastern traditions, would be complete without the West, and how could we imagine that the West would be complete without the East? In other words, these two really did have to integrate and marry one another, and I think Big Mind is a direct product of that. And my sense is it can only come about when a Westerner completely digests the Eastern tradition, and then from the Western mind comes out with a practice that, as you were talking about, that's suitable for the Western mind and Western practice, that's more psychologically sound. Because, frankly, the practice that we inherited here, whereas it worked in the East, it may not work as well here in the West, because we're of a different makeup, different culture, different mindset, and so forth. And so we really had to find a way that is accessible and not threatening and not so samurai-like as the Zen that I studied in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really insightful point you made, in terms of that that this integration of East and West that you're talking about can't just be a sort of a superficial pasting together of two different things, but really, as you said, has to come from somebody who's really digested and embodied that mystical wisdom, but then is going to maybe use some contemporary psychological insight and maybe new Western frames to give birth to new ways of practicing that are really still rooted in the wisdom and not just kind of a fusion.
That's right, absolutely. And that's, you just hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what it requires. It has to be really digested well. And there were early teachers who immediately in Zen saw the shortcomings of the tradition as it came over and started to throw certain things out and bring it more Western. But I felt that I needed to really wait a long time. And I actually waited almost 5 years, 4 years after the death of my teacher, before I started to really go into the big mind work and begin the integration of East and West, because I knew that it took time even to digest the death of our teacher. And I didn't want to, you know, leap too quickly. Sometimes Bernie has called me the tortoise, where he's the hare, because I've tried to go real slow on this, even though I think what we're doing is quite innovative and breaking a lot of old tradition. And yet I think the whole Buddha Dharma, the whole tradition, obviously is there in the big mind work. And we're seeing more and more of its integration, the Zen and the Western psychotherapy.
You know, a lot of people had this insight, of course, at certain points that, well, maybe Western psychotherapy could be added to Dharma practice. And I think there have been a lot of attempts to sort of add or import various psychotherapeutic enhancements to, say, meditation practice, things like this. But I know many of us, I'm not the only one who's a lot of people have said that simply adding some psychotherapy to one's meditation practice doesn't necessarily make for a more complete spiritual path, for the simple reason that the vast majority of psychotherapies were created to treat pathology rather than to lead to higher human functioning. And I mean, psychotherapy itself isn't in essence a Dharma tradition. It's not based in enlightenment or on enlightenment. So what I feel you've done, which I'm just intrigued by, was something very different than that. It's you took insights and methodologies from psychotherapy, but you really use them as a kind of architectural sort of frame for creating a new Dharma practice, if that makes sense. Is that kind of your sense of how you went about it?
Absolutely. That's exactly it. You know, I didn't study Western psychotherapy. I did a lot of psychotherapy, and I actually did counseling for people back throughout the 70s and 80s. And exactly what you were talking about, I tried too. After I learned the voice dialogue techniques in 1983 and 84 from Hal and Sidra Stone, I began in our longer retreats. We sometimes did as long as 90-day sessions, which meant 10 hours a day of Zazen and eating formally and walking formally and so forth. And we did these retreats, only taking the 30th and the 60th day off to wash our robes and clothes. So I would, at that time, bring in some of the voice dialogue work to make it more psychologically healthy and to get at some of the root causes where people were blocked in their spiritual practice. In other words, the psychological barriers can affect our spiritual growth and do. And a great Zen master by the name of Rinzai, you know, who lived a long time ago in China, said at one point, at this point in my age, all I do is remove barriers and untie knots. And those knots and barriers very often are psychological. So I began, and this was back around 87, 88, I began to introduce the voice dialogue work into the traditional trainings of sessions and angos. Angos are 90-day periods of training. However, it wasn't integrated until 99. And then it was only the seed. It only began in June of 99 and has over the last decade really evolved into an integrated whole. It took time.
Now, can you tell, because I mean, I know many people listening are probably familiar with Big Mind. I'm sure a great number are not. Can you take us maybe a little bit through the genesis of it, what voice dialogue is and how, and the insights that you had about how it, the kind of framework of voice dialogue could be, you know, transformed into something completely different that you call Big Mind, and give us a little introduction to how Big Mind works.
Sure. Let me just say what they have in common. The voice dialogue, going back to Jung and Gestalt therapy and some other therapies that Hal and Sidra Stone were very familiar with, and in fact, Hal Stone was the president of the Jungian Institute in Los Angeles at one time. So they had a deep background in the therapeutic, in the therapies and therapeutic techniques. And the voice dialogue, its assumption is that everything that is out there is also within us, and these are voices or aspects that are within the self, and they call them sub-selves or personality, you know, patterns within us, and that if you ask to speak to a voice, let's say the voice of anger, for instance, and you say, okay, I am the voice of anger, I speak for anger, I'm not the self, but I am anger, and I'm just that sub-personality. And what I started to notice back 83, 84, when I was doing this work with Hal, particularly Hal Stone, that it gave me enough distance from the self to begin to drop the self. In other words, by identifying with the voice or the subpersonality, I was able to disidentify from my attachment and identification with the self. Now, in Buddhism, we know that the self is illusory. It's a necessary part of our, you know, our being, but by and large, it's a concept. It's created in the mind. And that the idea that I am who I think I am, we know from Buddhism, is not so. And that in Buddhism, the whole point is to drop the self. So I started to see where these two really complemented each other. And that what was happening at the Zen Center in Los Angeles back then was that people, by using the voice dialogue technique, were actually strengthening their Zen practice because they were able to less identify, therefore be less attached to the self, and therefore drop the self in their Zazen practice or in their daily life practice.
Now, let me just ask something for clarification, because you're speaking about disidentifying with the self. And I know, for instance, because you were talking about in voice dialogue how you were realizing, in a sense, that you're... Would this explain it? You're realizing, in a sense, that your self isn't so much a self as it is a collection of all these different voices, and that it's less a kind of absolute entity as it is a sort of assortment of different characters that at any given point you're identified with. And through doing that, you started to get more objective look at, well, what is this self? It's obviously not this concrete, tangible me entity that I think it is. Was it something like that?
Absolutely. Again, right on. Obviously, you're very familiar with my work, but your insights are superb. Yes, absolutely. So what happens is that by seeing that the self is not solid, substantial, or permanent, we're able to let it go. Like, let me give you an example for our listeners. I obviously am more attached to my children than I would be to any of our listeners' children. And they would be more attached to their children than they are to my children. That's obvious. I'm also more attached to my notions, ideas, and beliefs than I would be to yours. Vice versa, you're more attached to your own ideas, beliefs, and concepts than you are to mine. The more identified we are with anything, the more attached we are to it. So I'm more attached to my own beliefs and concepts than I am to anybody else's. Therefore, when I'm that attached, that's what hangs me up. causes suffering, causes dukkha, and causes me to feel alienated or frightened or whatever else, and I suffer because of that. So the more distance I can create between, let's call it the true self, and the self that is limited and created, the more attached I'm going to be, therefore the more I'm going to suffer. And let me give an example. Like, if we take the voice of fear, and I speak from that voice of fear, what we're going to see, as soon as I start to talk as the voice of fear, I'm going to speak as the voice of fear, well, I'm the voice that my job is to be frightened. And what my job is, and my purpose is to protect Genpo, or warn him in a protective way that there's danger present, that this is dangerous to approach that bear right there, or to get too close to the edge, or to drive his motorcycle too fast, or to cut in and out of cars. I am here to serve a purpose, but I'm not Genpo. I'm the voice of fear. And by doing this, by this little exercise, what I see is that the self without me is pretty stupid. The self,
right,
without me, he would be fearless. And he thinks he wants to be fearless. He actually goes to workshops, does all this study and all this practice for years and years and years because he wants to be fearless. But where would he be without me? He would be unprotected and unwarned when there was ever-present danger. The same thing with anger. If I'm the voice of anger, I see that I work to serve Genpo. When somebody wrongs him or does something, I get angry. I'm able to help him make a change, to shift his life in a way that works for him. And without me, he doesn't know how to be angry. You know, he's just without anger. Or protector. As the protector, I'm here to protect him. You know, he would do the stupidest things without me, here to protect him. So what we find out is the self is not that bright. You know, there may be an intelligent aspect of the self, mm-hmm. the one that has wisdom, the one that has intelligence, that voice. But the self itself is just a conglomerate of voices. And apart from all these voices, there is no self. And that's basic Buddhism.
Hmm. And so then you were going to, I kind of interrupted there for a bit, but you were going to take us through then how you took us, how you then moved this, because I think you had an essential insight into voice dialogue and how it could be taken into a completely new arena that it had never gone before. Can you talk a little bit about that? How we got from voice dialogue to big mind?
Sure. Well, what I saw, and this was back in June of 99, it started a little earlier. I stopped calling it voice dialogue, and for a while I called it Zen dialogue, and then eventually Big Mind in June. What I saw was that knowing full well that within every one of us, we all have the Buddha wisdom, the Buddha mind, the heart of compassion, that's innate within every one of us. We all have that intrinsically. I knew that from all my study in Zen Buddhism. So what dawned on me one day was, if we can get in touch with disowned voices, voices that were there but maybe got suppressed. Like in 1972, I suppressed the voice of jealousy because I got so jealous I saw how dangerous and crazy that made me, I just decided I'm never getting jealous again. So that's called disowning a voice. And we have that around trust, and we have it around fear, and we have it around jealousy, and some of us have it around anger, and all these other emotions or feelings. So what I thought was, well, if we can get in touch with the voice of, let's say, suppressed jealousy or disowned jealousy, why can't we get in touch with the voices that are not disowned but have never been awakened previously? So
right.
I was in a workshop. I was leading a workshop in Salt Lake City, and there was a young man who I knew pretty well, but just out of college, and I said, "May I speak to Big Mind, please?" And he said, "Yes, you may." And I said, "All right, let me speak to Big Mind." And he said, "I am Big Mind." And I said, "I want you to take a moment and just settle into this Big Mind, being Big Mind, and tell me about you, Big Mind." And he started talking like it was the voice of the Buddha. I mean, everything out of his mouth was what you would read in the sutras. And I was like shocked. And I realized this young man who had very little practice was able to tap in to this ancient wisdom in a matter of an instant by shifting from identified with the self to identifying as big mind. And I knew I hit on something huge. And so I just kept working with him. And then eventually I did some other voices like the non-seeking self or the non-seeking mind, and the mind of content and the mind of satisfaction. And then it evolved into big heart and so on. But what I saw was that these aspects that have taken 10, 20, 30 years for people to have an enlightened experience could be aroused or connected to, let's say, what's the word I'm looking for, accessed in a matter of an instant by having them make a shift. First it was a physical, then a mental shift, and then I dropped the physical. We don't even need that anymore. Just a mental shift to identifying with the transcendent, with these parts of ourself that are beyond the self, that are limitless, eternal, and endless, infinite, simply by asking to speak to them and getting permission. So in the beginning, I made a big deal about getting the self or the controller's permission. Even that has, I've found, isn't necessary. As long as I know that the person can do it, somehow they're empowered by my trust that they can do it, and they can do it instantly. So, I mean, even our listeners right now, if I said, well, may I speak to the voice of Big Mind, and they say, yes, you're now speaking to the voice of Big Mind, and then take a moment to look in to just see if they can find any boundary, any limit, any edge to this Big Mind, and they will find, no, I am unborn, therefore undying, I am beginningless and endless, I'm eternal, I'm ever-present, I'm here now. I'm not in the past. I'm not in the future. I encompass it all. You know, and it's that easy and that accessible. And for some reason, this has eluded us for 2,500 years. And I think that's what the West brought to the table here, because in the East, we knew that the enlightened state was accessible, but the way we did it traditionally was through koan practice, where we'd give people puzzles to really try to resolve that couldn't be resolved in the dualistic or discriminating mind, and they had to transcend it. Or we might whack somebody with a stick or shout like Rinzai did, and in a sudden kind of instant startalization, the person might make a shift out of the self, drop the self, and into the space of the Buddha mind or the Big Mind. So all of that was known, but what we didn't know was how to access it.
Well, I want to jump in here because I'm getting excited because I have a little theory on this, and this has been a lot of what's catalyzed my own work with Integral Enlightenment, and it grew out of my work with Andrew Cohen over many years and all the work we were doing at Enlighten Next. But I've just started to kind of come to this thought, which is that, you see, you're familiar, of course, I'm sure, with kind of developmental theory, whether it's spiral dynamics or some of the other developmental psychological, you know, analyses of the human condition and how we've evolved through stages throughout history and also the kind of stages individuals move through. But one of the core insights from that whole body of work is that that our interiors evolve, and that in this new postmodern level of consciousness that, you know, those of us, kind of a large emerging group of people, are now inside of this new kind of stage of interior development, that part of what that's brought with it is a much greater depth of self-awareness and kind of introspective capacity, that in a sense the self, the person you experience yourself, or, and I don't mean you specifically, but kind of any of us probably listening to this call, that how we experience ourselves is radically different than even the way probably our grandparents experienced themselves, that we actually have much more access to our own emotional life, our inner life, and ability to reflect on it, look at it, kind of move in interior space. It's the birth of what some have called the sensitive self. A lot of it has had to do with the influence of psychotherapy just on our culture, on the way we were raised, etc. Now, so I've been thinking, well, okay, given that we now have this new level of interiority and self-awareness, how, you know, and many people have spoken about how that's a liability on the spiritual path because it's led to a greater level of narcissism and self-absorption and this endless fascination with the contents of our own psyches. But my thought has been, well, how can that be leveraged for our development? And some of the things that we were doing at Enlightened Next and the work I'm doing with Integral Enlightenment, but I really am hearing it in what you're articulating here, is that, because my sense is this, what you just described, I don't, and I'm going to have all the theorists come at me maybe and argue with me by email after this, but I think it wouldn't have worked 2,500 years ago, because I don't think people had the level of interiority and psychological sophistication and sensitivity to necessarily just be able to make an inner shift when told to, like, now go here, and the person has the kind of inner landscape and kind of navigational capacity to say, oh, I'm going to go over here and identify with this and start to speak from that. So my sense is this is a new, it's a new possibility for human beings to do this that does mean we can accelerate our spiritual progress dramatically. So what do you think about that? That's my theory of the day.
Well, no, I'm sorry to keep saying this. I totally agree with you. We didn't plan this, I know.
No. Well, I didn't know if you'd agree, but I'm just curious because I've really been thinking about this.
In fact, I've absolutely pondered this a lot, and I don't think it was possible until it happened. I don't even know if it was possible in 68. I mean, excuse me, in 98 or 97. I think we are evolving, and I think it had something to do with the new millennium. You know, I mean, this was just 6 months before, 2000. I think it would not have ever developed in the East. This is a Western technique for Western mind. And I think that even when I have done this with traditional Japanese Zen people, you know, who were raised and trained in Japan and are Japanese and of that culture, they have a much more difficult time comprehending and being able to do the big mind work than, say, somebody raised in the West. And there's a lot of reasons. The whole culture is different. The mind is different in some ways. Of course, on a superficial level, not on a depth level. But the whole notion of speaking to aspects of ourself is relatively new in our culture. As I said, I mean, I think Hal and Sidra Stone really pioneered this, but way back Fritz Perls, when I first started studying Fritz Perls in 68, I think it was, what I noticed was that by changing the chairs, you know, and speaking to my father had just died in June, and so I went to therapy because of that, and I would speak to my father who was passed away, and then I would take that seat and I would be my father and speak back to me and so on. Those concepts are relatively new. I mean, that's just 50 years. I don't think it could have happened on many, many levels, culturally, consciously, as you're saying, that we are evolving. Now, in that involvement, I think it's happening planetarily. I think I was just having this discussion with my wife this morning. You know, I think it's even animate things, I mean, inanimate things as well as animate things. Everything's evolving. Nothing is standing still. And we're connecting more and more to the source of consciousness, and we're finding techniques and ways, you know, I would even call it technology, ways to really move to the next level of consciousness, which I do believe we're going to do in the next few years, and that the whole planet is moving in this direction. So I agree that I don't think this could have been done 50 years ago or 20 years ago or maybe even 15 years ago.
Well, it's definitely an exciting time.
it is.
So So I have another question, which is that how then have you found as a pioneer in the way we're talking about, how has this fit in with traditional Zen practice? Because I see you also as somebody who really strives to remain true to your tradition. You're not just grabbing some Buddhism and running off into a whole new direction. I mean, you know, you're really, I think, also rooted in the traditional practice. How do these integrate, and how do you find them serving one another, meditation, etc.?
Well, it's true. I'm still at heart a traditionalist, but a kind of maverick or rebel in the tradition. I am not leaving the tradition. I've had over the last 38 years times when I've thought of leaving the tradition, but I always come back to the same point that if I want to transform the tradition, I have to be within the tradition. Otherwise, I'm just kind of leaving it and leaving that behind. And I do see myself in a way as a pioneer in the tradition. And we do a very traditional practice as well as a non-traditional practice of big mind. How I see big mind supporting tradition is when someone does big mind, immediately they're able to sit better and to sit with less identification to the self and therefore to the mind and to their thoughts. And almost immediately after an hour of big mind work, they're able to sit in a deeper samadhi, deeper silence, because the thoughts just come and go. And particularly if they use the technique, like when they sit down and take their posture and do their swaying back and forth and then get into it and they say, may I speak to the non-seeking or non-grasping mind or the non-seeking and non-grasping mind? And they say, okay, I am now the non-seeking mind. And then they just sit. And they see that immediately they don't need to seek enlightenment. They're in the present. They're in the here and now. And they're allowing everything to the thoughts and emotions and feelings to come and go. And they're not being hooked by them. They're not being trapped by them. They're not being dragged around by them. And they're not being brought into thinking about the past or dwelling on the future or whatever. They're really in a place where they're ever present and just sitting, and what we call in Japanese shikantaza, to just sit. There's another term we use in Japanese Zen called mushotoku, which means to sit in the mind that has no goal and no aim. And the way that traditionally we did it was we would tell the student, sit without a goal or an aim. But immediately the goal or the aim was to sit without the goal or aim. So they stayed in the seeking mind, seeking how to be non-seeking. And this is really, I think, the brilliance of the big mind work, is the moment the practitioner or person identifies as the non-seeking mind. I am the non-seeking mind. I'm the non-grasping mind. And then just sits. They're not seeking to be non-seeking. They are non-seeking. And then from that place, they can actually watch the seeking mind do its thing. They can observe it. They can witness it. They can see it trying to seek, but they're not identified with it any longer. Therefore, they can easily drop the seeking. Now, you're familiar with my triangle work, but many listeners maybe are not. But I use 3 points, which is very traditional. We can say Hinayana, Buddhayana, and Mahayana, or we can say some of the other Buddhist terms, like the absolute, the relative, and the identity of the absolute and relative. The way I look at it is a triangle is, if we look at the left corner of the triangle and we say, well, this is the seeking mind. This is the mind that has desires and cravings. It's the human side of the triangle, of our human beingness. And it's the part of us that is seeking to improve ourselves. Last week I gave a talk, I called it, let me speak to the wannabe. I want to be this, I want to be that, I want to be greater, I want to be more, I want to be different, I want to be, you know, I want my life to mean more, I want to make a difference, I want to be, I want to be, I want to be. So that's that left-hand corner. And there's nothing wrong with that. when we get enlightened or we get spiritual, sometimes we see, well, that voice is a liability, like the ego is a liability. Or even you mentioned the narcissist. The narcissist is a huge liability. The point of the big mind work is not to disown these voices, like the narcissist or the ego, but to actually give voice to them and to hear from them, because each voice has something to offer. Even jealousy has something to offer. I remember my own teacher saying one time, jealousy is the only emotion that has no redeeming quality whatsoever. It's not true. It's not true. If you go into jealousy deep enough, you can actually annihilate egocentredness if you go into it deep enough, which I did back in 1994.
How so? Sorry, I just wanted to... It's simply, like, well, what do you mean by how does jealousy take us beyond self-centeredness? What did you mean?
Okay, every emotion contains at least two of the three poisons. The three poisons are greed, anger, and ignorance. So out of our ignorance comes greed and anger or hatred, okay? And mm-hmm. those three poisons make up the ego. So the delusion that I am a separate self is the beginning of ignorance, okay? Mm-hmm. And out of that, when I get jealous, it's because I want to possess something or somebody, okay, or something. Well, let's say I want to possess my wife, okay? I want to own her. I want to possess her. I want to control her, okay? And somebody else is coming into the picture, let's say. I get angry. So out of ignorance or delusion comes greed, and out of that greed comes anger. And it's all based in fear that I'm going to lose something that I am identified and attached to.
Right.
It's the only emotion, jealousy is the only emotion that I can come up with that has all three ingredients, greed, anger, and ignorance. Anger just has two. The other emotions only have two. But that one has all three. So if we go into jealousy, which is what I did, in a visualization way in meditation, and we go into worst case scenario of what it takes to make me really jealous, really insane, and you go into that in a practice form, like I was doing lots of prostrations and lots of meditation 24 hours of the day for over several weeks, when you go into that, you will destroy the ego because the ego just can't survive. That's how powerful that particular emotion is. It's more powerful than any other emotion that I'm aware of. So it has the potential to actually annihilate the ego. Now, of course, the ego comes back.
So just to be clear, you're not so much saying that jealousy itself has redeeming qualities. You're saying that it's a very powerful emotion to work with in the deconstruction of ego. Would that be more? As opposed to there's something good about it on its own. I just wanted to make sure I got you.
Well, no, there may be something good about it on its own, too. You know, Okay. When you're in touch with any of your emotions, you become more vulnerable. Like if I express to someone, you know, I'm jealous. You know, I'm jealous of what you're doing here. I become more vulnerable and I become more human-like.
Well, there's a vulnerability in admitting something that's... Yeah, that you lack something that you want, sure. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think a lot of us have a lot of fear around the voice of jealousy because it is so potentially harmful and dangerous and insane. You know, I mean, it can cause one to go really insane. What I'm saying in the voice dialogue work and in the work of Big Mind, the point is to get in touch with all these voices. Like, let's say the ego, for example. The ego itself creates egocentredness and self-centeredness, and it's all about me. However, if I'm able to really own my ego and own the fact that, you know, I am egocentered, I mean, bottom line is I'm concerned about myself and my well-being and all the teaching that I do and all the work that I do, and it looks so noble and it looks so altruistic, it helps me because I love it. I'm enjoying my work. I'm enjoying helping people wake up. But it's all about me. I mean, down deep, it's always about oneself. And when I disown that, and I say, oh, no, I'm egoless, I'm selfless, I've had these experiences of dropping the self, and I'm spiritual, that is probably the most self-centered and ego-centered viewpoint I could take. You know, I mean, who are you going to trust more? One who says, you know, I'm a complete phony, or one who says, you know, I'm not phony at all. I'm real. I'm the authentic, real person here. And there isn't anything phony about me. That's bullshit. You know, the one who can say, you know, I am a fake. I am phony. I am egotistical. I do get jealous. I do get angry. I am vulnerable.
Well, I think what I hear in what you're saying is that to the degree that we're in denial of these things, we can't really be trusted. To the degree that we're facing them, we recognize our potential for error, then we are much more likely to not make the error of acting out of those unwholesome drives. That kind of thing?
Yeah. Again, absolutely, yes. Yes. What we want to do is we want to be in touch with all aspects of ourself. And as I mentioned in the Western voice dialogue work, where it was on the same page as Zen Buddhism, is in Zen and in Buddhism we have what we call the mandala. And the mandala is all the aspects of ourself, and none of them should be excluded or disowned or denied. And in the voice dialogue work, it was the same thing, that every aspect out there is within me. So if it exists in a Hitler, it exists within me. If it exists in an Osama bin Laden, it exists within me. If it exists in an Obama, it exists in with me, you know, or a Mother Teresa. So all those aspects that are external are also within me, and I need to get in touch with those aspects if I want to be whole, complete person.
Okay, I want to push into this a little bit, because the next thing I kind of wanted to go into was transformation itself. And, you know, because these days I think many people, because as you know, we're in a sort of spiritual renaissance, the great wisdom of the world is now available at our fingertips, and many people are having powerful spiritual openings, experiences of all kinds, satori's, enlightenment experiences. And I think there, for many people, there's been a kind of presumption that, well, once you've had some big experiences, that means you're sort of enlightened now. I mean, we have a lot of spiritual teachers running around thinking they're enlightened and proclaiming they're enlightened because they had some big satori experience once. And as I'm sure you've encountered some of that yourself. Obviously, transformation, you know, from a traditional perspective or just a simple common sense perspective, is much more than just having deep experiences or even ongoing access to higher states of consciousness. It's really, I mean, one frame for it would be to say it's about a transformation of our motivation and of where we're coming from, where we're acting from in how we engage with the world, that it would no longer be from an ignorant, deluded, egocentric, you add your favorite poison place, but would be from a more enlightened, wiser, you know, place. And in terms of what you were just saying, what I want to ask about is, because I just think there's some nuance required here to really get the point that I think you're driving at when you say we want to make room for and embrace all the aspects of ourselves to be whole. Because I hear some people using that kind of language, and what they mean when I press them on is they say, well, it means that you just accept that you have all of these aspects, and you've got these darker aspects, and sometimes you're going to act out of those and really hurt people because of your ignorance or your unreflected upon anger or all of your negative tendencies. And sometimes you're going to be a beautiful person because you have these good sides, and that what it means to be whole is to just notice that we are all of those things, and we just accept them and embrace them. And they say that's why we just need to embrace the ego for what it is. And yeah, sometimes it can really cause a lot of pain and karma, but hey, that's just being human. Now, I would say that frame is a complete misunderstanding. And I just want to make sure that we're together on this, or to see if you agree, because what I would hear, I think, in what you're saying is not that, but that we want, if we're going to be truly whole, meaning if we're going to be able to engage the world from an enlightened place, that we need to be deeply aware of, present to all, everything in us that is not so enlightened, everything in us that's rooted maybe in our ancient evolutionary past, all of our kind of negative conditioning, our kind of more, maybe our, you could say our animal nature, since we evolved from animals, we are animals, and we still are driven by a lot of primitive impulses that really don't serve us well, and that we need to be fully cognizant of that, not in any way denying any of that, in order, though, to not act out of it and to start to make the enlightened choice to act out of our higher nature. And or in your sense, you know, big mind, maybe our Buddha nature, we can step into it, access it, and then start to let that be the guide for our choices, but only if we're really engaging and not in any way avoiding this full picture. Is that the direction you're going more?
Yeah, again, yes. But let me talk about two things. Let me finish the analogy of the triangle.
Yeah.
I didn't finish it, and that gets to exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, great.
Okay, so if the left-hand side is our human side of our human nature, it's with all the aspects and the emotions and the shadows and, you know, the positive and negative parts of ourself or aspects of ourself, and all that's in the human, then over here on the right-hand base of the triangle is the transcendent. It's the no-self, the no-mind, the big mind, the Buddha mind, the Christ consciousness, pure awareness, pure consciousness, the unborn, the undying, all that's over here on the right-hand side of the triangle, which we call the transcendent or the ever-present nowness or whatever we want to use. That's also the place of no ego. It's also the place of no hope. It's also the place of no mind. When we then access that, as you were talking about, in a daily practice, and that's where meditation or Zazen comes in, where you actually spend part of your day accessing that which is beyond all the boundaries, beyond the limits, beyond fear and anger and self and ego, when we access that, we become more balanced, more in harmony. And at the apex, when we shift into the apex, that which includes, embraces these two, the human and the beingness over here on the right-hand side, and we are truly coming from the place of the human being, which includes and yet transcends the human and the being, then we're coming from an egoless ego or a selfless self. We don't deny that I have a self, although it's not permanent, fixed, or restricted or limited. It's beyond that. But I have a self, and I have an ego, but I'm not hurting people because I acknowledge my ego. In fact, when I can acknowledge my ego and see myself and observe myself being self-centered, I actually can drop it. Versus when I'm in denial that I have an ego or self, that's when I act out, and that's when I do exactly what you, Craig, were talking about doing. If I'm over here thinking I'm enlightened, and there's an enlightened way, an enlightened perspective, and that's me, and all these other people are deluded and somehow ignorant, I'm going to help them, that's when I can abuse my power. That's when I can come from a place of denied ego where I'm actually covertly acting out of my ego. Where the big mind is so healthy psychologically is we can come from the apex where I can acknowledge my ego-centeredness, my self-centeredness, I can acknowledge my power, and then not abuse my power. So I think that what we're talking about here is the same thing, that when we come from the apex, we're going to have a much healthier and compassionate place where we come from. In Zen, we would call this the place where, out of wisdom, prajna wisdom, we act with compassion. And that compassion can be feminine, be very supportive and very sweet and very loving and very kind, but also at times it needs to be more like fatherly love or masculine, setting limits and could even be ruthless compassion, where we are very direct and very penetrating in what we say, either to ourselves or to another, if we're in the right position and place and time and so forth to do that. The other thing I want to talk about were stages. A lot of my teachings about what I call the five stages of the path of the human being, because many people, as you were saying, Craig, have that first experience, what we would call an enlightened or Kensho experience or Satori experience, and think that that's it. Now I'm enlightened. That's just the beginning. That's what we call in Zen awakening the Bodhi mind, the awakened mind, awakening the awakened mind that then seeks for further clarification, further depth, and further enlightenment. The second stage, which many people never get to, is called the stage of surrender and submission. And there is surrender and submission to the way, capital W, to the way, to the Buddha Dharma, to a spiritual path, maybe to a teacher of any path, of any spiritual practice. But it's only through that that we can really work on our ego. If we don't have an outside agent, then we've got our own ego as our master. And the ego as a master is a very, very problematic thing. It's like trying to do surgery on ourselves and having ourselves as our own surgeon. Unless it's pretty minor surgery, we're not going to attempt that. So spiritual practice, we need an outside, and in our lineage we'd call it an embodiment of the Buddha Dharma, someone who really has mastered the awakened state and actually comes from a place of wisdom and compassion. The second stage is to submit to that lineage, to that tradition, to that practice completely, and that's what we were talking about earlier when I was saying swallow the whole fish. The third stage, where all of us want to get to, but we want to skip the second stage, is great enlightenment. What we call in Zen Daikensho, a great enlightened experience, a great awakening, great liberation. That is an experience of really not just glimpsing the Absolute, but becoming one with the Absolute. And this is the full awakening. However, it's a very dangerous place to get stuck in, because at this place we feel absolute power. And we're seen as an enlightened being, and there is a tendency to not acknowledge cause and effect at this level, third stage. And that's what makes it so dangerous. Okay. The fourth stage, which in the tradition, our tradition, is called advanced achievement. I call it falling from grace, and I know you're familiar with this. When you fall from grace means that you let go of that enlightened place that you've been dwelling. For me, it was 8 years in that place from 86 to 94, where I got stuck in that, what we'd call enlightened place. And when you're stuck there, you create a lot of karma. In 94, when I went through this, where I told you I was going through the visualization of jealousy and so forth, and actually at that place really dropped the enlightenment. It was like falling from grace. And now, once again, we start to integrate the personal back into the impersonal, the relative back into the absolute. And so the fourth stage, we're really more in the relative world again, coming from the relative side of reality, because the absolute and relative are one reality seen from two different perspectives. But in this place, we feel all the pain of the world, all the suffering of the world, all the fear in the world, the anxiety, and so forth. We can feel it in our own bones, in our own being. We're no longer separate from it, because we've gone through the experience of being one with all things so completely. The fifth stage is the integration of the relative and absolute, where once again, we actually choose, and this is the on my triangle, it's the apex, where we consciously choose to be a human being and to come from a place where we are a human being, whole and complete, and yet we have tons to work on. And it's 1 o'clock, my time. Mm.
You nailed it. Good work.
I'm doing that.
Well, thank you. I
one of the real challenges I still have is how to nail it on the minute.
You hit it. Well, I would love to ask you a bunch more questions, but I know there are a lot of people listening who have their own questions for you. So we're going to shift gears now to the part where we take questions. If you have a question for Genpo Roshi, simply send us your question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or you can dial into the conference line number and just wait until I ask for a question from someone in your region of the world. That's how we manage the cacophony of questions all at once, as we do it region by region. Before we take your questions, though, I just want to mention a few of our sponsors who are making all this possible. First, I want to tell you a bit about our co-hosts for this event, Integral Life. If you're enjoying today's event, you will love Integral Life. They feature over 150 hours of audio and video discussions with today's great thinkers, leaders, visionaries, and artists, mostly moderated by Ken Wilber. They're making a special offer to all participants in the Great Integral Awakening. If you sign up for a premium membership, they'll give you a month free, including a free DVD, 2-CD set with all of their content from that month shipped to you for free. Just go to startyourintegrallife.com. That's startyourintegrallife.com. And on the subject of free, if you haven't yet visited integralenlightenment.com, go there today and download our free guided meditation, Opening to the Great Perfection. At integralenlightenment.com, you'll also find a collection of free audios, articles, and videos exploring what it means to live an authentic spiritual life in today's world. I also want to tell you about three upcoming events hosted by our sponsors. First, Genpo Roshi, Ken Wilber, and Bernie Glassman Roshi are hosting a two-day workshop called Enlightenment in the Western Mind in Denver. That's August 29th and 30th. To learn more, visit vastsky.org. That's vastsky.org. And for any educators in the audience, check out Next Step Integral. They're inviting you to their five-day integral education seminar starting August 2nd with over 15 faculty, including Suzanne Cook-Greuter, Terry O'Fallon, Terry Patton, and myself. And you can check that out at nextstepintegral.org. Okay, we're going to open this up for questions. If you have a question for the Roshi, simply send us your question via instant message in the teleseminar window on your computer, or dial into the conference line number and I'll ask for questions from someone in your region. So I'm going to start out by taking a few live questions, then I'll do some by instant message. So just let me get this set up here. Okay, so the way it is now is you can unmute yourself, but don't do it till I call on your region. Let's go ahead and start out on the West Coast this time. We usually go the other way. So do we have anyone on the West Coast? If so, press star 6 and say your name and the city you're from.
This is Kay from Santa Cruz.
Hey, Kay. What's your question?
Well, I wanted to ask Genpo. Genpo, I've known of your work since 1972, and I am very interested in your big mind process. I'm wanting to know, although I'm aware that you are having a seminar coming up in August, I'm wanting to know if you are available to work with students one-on-one, perhaps on the telephone. Does Big Mind work on the telephone?
It does, actually. It works very well. And I do some telephone work. Not a lot, because it takes up a lot of my time. But I am available. And it does work.
Okay. Okay, so if you want to be in touch with Genpo, you can check in through his organization at bigmind.org and email to find out details.
And I want to thank Kay for bringing up the work in San Francisco, because there's still room in that workshop, and the workshop is half the normal cost. It's very inexpensive, and I will be doing 6 hours Saturday and 6 hours on Sunday of Big Mind work, which will be, I think, very, very valuable for whoever attends.
Great. And they can learn all about that at bigmind.org, correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much for your work today, Genpo. I think it's incredibly valuable.
Thank you, Kay. Okay, let's take someone from the Intermountain region, Intermountain West, or the Midwest.
Is that Denver?
Hi, what's your name?
This is Melanie, and I had to go on and off the call. I'm wondering if I'll be able to hear it in its entirety, and may I ask a question out of context?
Yes, go ahead and ask your question for Genpo Roshi, and yes, you'll be able to listen to the call later.
Thank you. I counted up one day about 17 different techniques I use to feel centered and to think differently than my first interpretation of something. So I guess what I'm talking about is how is the very act of thinking I need to do these practices to be in the presence different than reacting from the conditioned mind? Is that the very act of doing that entrenching me in the automatic mind? In other words, should I give up my 17 tools?
Well, I can't tell you whether to give them up or not. At some point, you probably
will. It seems like a lot of work. It just seems
It probably is too much. All techniques will work for a while, and then at some point they cease to work, and you let them go. I've done a lot of different work and techniques myself over the past 40 years, and eventually you can let these techniques go. It's like a roadmap. When you need the roadmap, you use it, and when you no longer need it, you put it aside or back in the glove compartment, or a canoe taking you to the other shore. At some point, you're at the other shore. You don't need those techniques. But, I might pick one or two of these techniques and really use them until you no longer need them.
I seem to have a very wild and crazy amygdala. And I'm just beginning to realize in the last two or three days, watching myself, how hypervigilant I am.
Right. Well, this is also where a tradition and a teacher is useful, because I know that I was into many different things. I was into integral yoga way back in 71 and 2 when I met my Jimmy Roshi. I was into Krishnamurti, and I was into a lot of different things. And when you have a teacher and a tradition, then you kind of just ask the teacher what to do, and they give you a practice, a technique, and you can drop all the others and then work on that.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question, Melanie.
Thank you.
How about someone from the East Coast of the U.S.? We'll take the question from Boston. What was your name?
Joe.
Hey, Joe.
Hi. I talked about this a bit on the Facebook page, but in my studies and practices, I perceive that there are more levels above what we can actually access in our awareness. And I would say that there is actually an individuality. It's not permanent, it's not fixed, but it is a self, really beyond the self, that's not the same necessarily as the selves of others. And so I guess, and I talked to Diane Musho Hamilton about this, I think that my big mind may not be the same as someone else's big mind. And I'm wondering if you could chime in on that. And I had heard Ken Wilber once say that the biggest arguments you'll hear is when you get several enlightened people in the room together. And I think that kind of bears that idea out. Could you talk about that? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And let me say this. One of the experiences, actually, it's the third level that I was talking about, the third stage, is where we see there are no Buddhas, there are no enlightened beings, there is a no enlightened self. And that's very liberating, to say the least. And one of the barriers to really seeing that is how attached we are to having some outside authority or authorities that we can rely on and depend on to sanction us and to tell us that finally we're okay. given that the big mind is universal. So if you really access big mind, it's not personal. And so it is a universal experience of no mind and no self. And then, of course, we all come back to this limited mind, this limited self, and then we may interpret it different ways. We may translate it in different ways. We may try to express it in different ways. But the experience is universal. It's a cosmic consciousness or universal consciousness. It's the same whoever, at whatever period of time we're in, whatever culture we're in, it's the same experience. Does that answer your question?
Maybe. I think not quite. What I'm thinking is if you wanted to look at life as, say, a giant video game, and you would get this experience of cosmic consciousness, it's almost like popping out of the television set and seeing that the whole game is happening on the television set. But meanwhile, we're mistaking the fact that there is someone sitting in an easy chair with a video controller in their hands, and they are the actual self playing the game, and not necessarily the same actual self as the person sitting on the couch with another controller in their hands. So by seeing the entire universe as just the television screen is mistaking the fact that there's a whole lot going on beyond that.
Well, I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call, Joe.
All right. Thank you.
I wanted to say how much I really appreciate both you, Craig, for this series, and also Genpo, what you were doing. I've been working with Big Mind kind of on my own, you know, trying to do my own thing. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit in the time we have left about a teacher and getting feedback, because I know Big Mind and the Evolutionary Impulse, which is Andrew's teaching, which I commend you for working with him and that group. But could you speak a little bit, because I know that this has a definite flavor to it that's different from my ordinary experience. It has a definite different texture to it. And I was just wondering if you could speak about the necessity of having a teacher or having some people who are farther along the path to help out, maybe give some feedback on this.
Sure.
You
know? Sure. Well, let me say this. You know, I think a teacher is only necessary if one is ready to have a teacher and wants to really accomplish in this lifetime as much as they possibly can. You know, if you're a musician or an athlete and you want to be a great athlete, a great golfer, a great water polo or swimmer or what those are the things I was into, you really look for the best coach. And I had 7 Olympic coaches during my career as a swimmer and water polo player. And they push you to continually go beyond your limits and your boundaries.
The push.
Like a coach.
What would the actions of the push be? Or the experience and the action?
Well, part of it is, as a teacher, you know, and I've been teaching for more than 30 years, you try to inspire and push your students to continue to want to be enlightened or awakened or fully embody the enlightened and awakened state as much as you want it for them to want it for themselves. Sometimes I'm very frustrated how I can want them to awaken, my students to awaken, more than they want it themselves. And sometimes resistance, slothfulness, you know, just laziness, a lack of wanting to go deeper and to question more can become a hindrance. And where the teacher comes in is to really encourage and even push us to continue to go deeper, to clarify further, that we're not at the end. Very often in spiritual practice, when we get to that place where we're content, satisfied, and happy, and we don't have this strong seeking mind, we want to stop there, and we want to disown the seeking mind because we see that the place of the non-seeking is really what we're looking for. But it takes a teacher to say, no, there's another mountain to climb, there's further to go, and so forth. Okay?
Sorry.
That's great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Following up and asking about feedback, because this I asked about a teacher, and I think that with a lot of this spiritual stuff, we really do need a teacher, because I know that when you were showing Andrew Cohen's I don't know if you were correct. But he actually, there was actually people from Andrew's group that were studying, and you showed them the Mu koan, and they I heard then that you had some feedback on that, that they were really kind of impressed with that, you know. And I've been kind of working on koans myself, and I've been going through like the picking and choosing koan, whatever, and looking at these different things, and I've been thinking that I'm actually making some headway, but. You know, I'm particularly interested in feedback because I can realize how easy it is to, you know, think we're enlightened and then we try to go out around people and we can't even explain what we're doing, you know. At least I'm not
so
experienced.
The feedback is the push. The feedback is coaching.
Well, the and the want to get better.
Roshi, do you have a response?
Let me say something to that.
And let me can I ask everyone to press star 6 who has unmuted just so we can clear the line again? And we'll let Roshi respond. Great.
Thank you.
Go for it.
Yeah. When we have a koan, we absolutely need feedback because we think maybe that we get the answer to the koan, and it's only a teacher who's gone through the koan study that can give us really an accurate and legitimate confirmation of, yes, this is a genuine Kensho experience, yes, you're seeing the koan clearly, or no, you're not. Because, like, take the koan that the gentleman just mentioned. The koan goes something like this. The perfect way is not difficult. It just abhors or hates picking and choosing. A lot of people think that they're there because they're not picking and choosing. That's not the answer to the koan. The answer to the koan has more to do with coming from the apex than it does from the transcendent. And when I go to the supermarket, I particularly prefer wheat bread, whole wheat bread, than I do the white bread. So I'm going to pick wheat bread every time over the white bread. And I don't have a problem with picking and choosing. The Mu koan, a lot of people think they get the Mu koan when the teacher says, well, what is Mu? And the word is non-translatable. It basically means negation or nothingness. And they'll say, well, everything is Mu, the stars, the sun, the planet, all beings are Mu. That's not the answer. That's just the peeling of the first layer of the onion. It's not deep enough. So we cannot be our own teacher in koans. That is totally, in our tradition, a no-no. It does not work. Because then you've got the ego as your master, and the ego, as I said earlier, is a terrible master. So we actually need a teacher to present the koan with face-to-face, and then from there, either we're acknowledged as seeing the koan, or we have to keep working on it. And part of the process is being rejected over and over again, that we're not there yet, and then we go deeper and deeper and deeper, and that's the push that we were talking about earlier, where the teacher actually pushes a student to go deeper.
Great. Great, thank you. I want to see if we've got anybody from Europe who wants to ask Genpo Roshi a question. If you do, or actually let's say anywhere outside the U.S. You can be anywhere outside the U.S., press star 6 and ask your question. Okay, I think we lost them all. Problem is we have most of the Europeans listening, of course, to the webcast, and that has failed us now. So,
Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Hello? Mind if I ask a question? Yes, hello. My name is Ted, calling from Boston.
Yeah, sure, Ted. Go for it.
Thanks, Craig. Roshi, much gratitude for all the work you've been doing lately. I actually was in retreat with you a couple of years ago, and I currently have a Mahayana Buddhist practice. And what I find is with the Sangha I'm in, when I try to kind of bring in the integral or the evolutionary perspective into it, I find that a lot of people will kind of reflect on it as being sort of this driving or grasping, and they kind of bring the whole Buddhist metaphysics into it, that really there is no evolutionary perspective, that things are kind of cyclical. And I guess I'm having sometimes some difficulty with reconciling this aspect of it, that our evolution isn't just passive, but it's something that we take an active role in it, that we have a responsibility to it. And I know this kind of ties in a little bit with Andrew's teachings, which I know you've recently had a meeting with him and his students, and is also Craig's former teacher. I just wanted you to kind of reflect on this and this idea of sort of bringing an evolutionary perspective into Buddhism, and is it really sort of this striving and grasping that kind of overtakes
that idea?
Well, let me say this. It's easy for any of us to get stuck. And I myself have been stuck, get stuck, and probably still stuck. And we don't realize we're stuck until we're no longer stuck in that place. And part of the process or the evolution of one's own growth is continually working to evolve and to see where I am stuck. I always tell my students, never ask, am I stuck? Just ask, where am I stuck? Because at some place, it's kind of like the monkey bars that we played with as kids. Every time we release one hand, the other one's already stuck. Then we stick that one, and then we release the next one. But we're constantly stuck, and we're constantly evolving. But sometimes we stay stuck for a very, very long time. The word stuck actually is what the word dukkha means. It's when the wheel of an axle does not turn any longer, and the cart goes around in circles. That's dukkha. Because one wheel is not, maybe a stick got in there and got wedged in, and that wheel won't turn. We have to take out that cog from the wheel and get the cart now functioning again, fully functioning. So we continually get stuck, and we need to really look at where we're stuck. And when we're in the tradition, any tradition, whatever tradition we're in, obviously the tradition supports us, but we can also get stuck in the tradition with certain perspectives and not stay beginner's mind or open mind, or even we could say an intelligent mind. And so we do encounter that here and there.
Thank you very much. That helps out a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay. So do we have someone else? Anywhere now. Hi, what was your name again?
Jay,
hi.
Yes, I was just, it's funny because, you know, all the teachings that are brought to mankind to bring about enlightenment, and even with, you know, universalism to try and prevent the narrowness of the mind, seem to, and you know, I notice over a very short period of time, you know, there seems to be a major click going on in terms of a new intelligence, an intuitive one, because, you know, we can feel the presence of the path. It's a lightening of the will, and we get so easily fooled. We try to wrap our intellect around it, and instead of, we try and take it with us rather than going with it, and it doesn't work. So, you know, it's always this course of surrendering. I mean, like, sometimes I wish I could surrender my will like I would return a pair of pants to Marshalls, but it isn't that easy.
No, it's not that easy, is it?
It definitely is not. You know, I think one thing I wanted to get kind of loan here is, because I've seen you work with the big mind, I think it's great how you can almost like talk to these entities. But, you know, it's just so imperative, I think, to bring the intuitive intelligence to today's scene for the spirituality really to take its grasp. There is a website called Mission of Maitreyas who does some real lucid work with old religious texts and stuff, probably be worth people looking into. But I'm going to sit back and listen. Thank you, people.
Hey, thanks, Jay. Go ahead and hit *6 again, and we'll hear Roshi's response.
Well, you know, I think that, in a way, one of the barriers or hindrances is when we're stuck in our intellectual mind or our discriminating mind. And sometimes there's nothing more stupid than an intelligent person who thinks they're so intelligent, because I really think that an open, receptive mind is an intelligent mind. And we often get so identified with our intellect that it becomes a hindrance in our practice. And as Jay said, we just need to surrender that, and it's not so easy to surrender the intelligent mind or the will. But in part of our work, we have to find out what it is like to go beyond the discriminating, discursive mind into that intuitive, or even intuitive doesn't really do it justice, into the mind of innate wisdom and consciousness.
Fantastic. All right, let's do one more, and then we'll wrap. Do we have anybody else who'd like to ask a question? Just hit star six, say your name and where
you're from. This is Dale in Atlanta.
Dale in Atlanta. Okay, we'll take Dale. If everyone else can hit star six, that'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Craig, and thank you, Genpo, for taking my question. Genpo, I would like to ask you about how do you feel selfless acts of selfless service come into play here?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, a lot of it is being conscious and aware that there is no selfless service in a way. As we move more and more beyond the self and still realize that there's a self involved in it, it comes from the heart, and it comes from seeing the connection and interconnection to all things, and that, you know, there's really this heart connection that you are me and I am you. And, you know, it's not even something that we will to happen. It's almost like you can't help but want to have all beings awaken and to serve all beings, because it's no other than oneself. And so that would be my response to your question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well,
move on before we end real quick.
Squeeze it in. Go for it.
Well, you were talking about how the mu koan is, and a koan is basically something you can't solve, but I said
you can't, wait, you can't solve with the discriminating and discursive mind.
Right, and it's a tool to get that out of the way. You said that the mu koan is kind of like a negation of something, and in
correct.
My understanding, when we talk about the evolutionary impulse, we're not talking about something that's form, we're talking about like creativity, something that we're trying to push forward. And so what we want to do is do like the mu koan, for instance, or any number of koans, to kind of get the conscious mind tied up in doing something else. And, you know, if we're so intelligent, let's just play with that for a while and then let what I call the subspace mind, or maybe big mind, give us intuitive information about where we need to go in our practice and how to really get out of our head and into our heart and how to, you know, engage with people around us. And I think that it's not like one person does this mu koan, that means that we know it. We can still have an opportunity to negate what we think we know and to negate what our conscious mind tells us is really going on, which is a very narrow, focused, like, map of something, which is useful,
Let me ask you, do you know what mu is?
No, not really. I mean, I have ideas.
Okay, tell me some of your ideas of what mu is.
Well, my idea is it can stand for anything, but it's basically just an object of meditation. Like my breath could be an object of meditation. And if I meditate on mu and something happens, well, I'm getting in touch with something outside of the self, because I was focusing on my breath and then something happened with this mu. Well, it's maybe everything extra, but it negates everything, so it's...
All right, so let me help you here. Let me speak to mu, please. Let me speak to mu. Okay, who am I speaking to? Who am I speaking to?
Mu.
All right, now just sit as mu. Just sit as mu. I'm speaking to mu. Just sit right now as mu.
Okay.
And tell me what the difference is between this state of mind and who was just talking a minute ago. Tell me about you as mu.
It just feels like there's more flexibility because, you know,
absolutely.
I've done the big mind.
No. Wait. Just speak as mu. Stop talking as the self. Just speak as mu. I am mu.
Like,
say that.
I am mu. Okay.
And just see the shift in consciousness now, and you're not the self any longer. So I don't want you to speak as the self. I want you to speak as mu.
Well, it definitely seems like there's more flexibility.
How about spaciousness?
There's definitely enough spaciousness for me to just talk, for me to just say what's on my mind, you know.
Okay, so as mu, who are you?
I am, pretty much.
That's right.
Could it be
I am.
That's really cool.
Okay. Now look at the self, the one that was talking about mu, and tell me what you see when you look directly at the self who was speaking about you a moment ago?
Well, I think he's got, like, you know, feather in one hand and molasses in the other, and he thinks he's going to slap them together and try to pull them apart and pick off the feathers. And that's just,
exactly.
You know, it's good exercise, but it's not, it's like the treadmill. It's not really going anywhere.
Correct. Beautiful.
But this,
great,
and I knew this before, but now it feels somehow different. And it's like I could say, okay, I'm one with everything. But before I did that, I didn't really know. And I think I still have more to do if I speak as Mu. Like, can I just do it myself? How do I, like, ask myself to speak to Mu? Maybe could you say a little bit about how we're supposed to use big mind ourselves like this?
Sure. So when you sit, yeah, it is cool. When you sit down on your meditation cushion or on your chair, you just say, may I speak to Mu, or may I speak to the non-seeking mind, or may I speak to the big mind, or may I speak to the mind that is complete and content, and then you just sit. Just sit as Mu. In other words, you're not trying to access Mu, you're not trying to attain Mu, you're not trying to get to Mu, you just sit as Mu. We could call that Shikan Mu, just Mu, just sit as Mu. Okay?
Well, that's, I like that. No, we no longer have to pick and choose, and it's not really difficult anymore.
Yeah, another one
okay.
You can use is, let me just say, you can speak as the breath. Let me speak to the breath. I am the breath, and just sit as the breath. Go ahead, Craig. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead if you have more. I was just going to wrap things up, so I didn't know if you had anything else to add.
No, I was just going to say, people who are used to following the breath, there's still a separation between the follower of the breath and the breath. But if they simply say, may I speak to the breath? Okay, I am the breath. Okay, now sit. I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. This was actually the practice of the Buddha. I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. But now the I is the breath rather than the self. I'm not the self, I'm the breath breathing in and breathing out. It's a beautiful way to meditate.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I know many people have more questions. I'd love to chat for another hour myself. I really enjoyed our conversation a great deal, and I felt a lot came out. So I just want to thank you. And do you have, you mentioned you've got an event coming up in San Francisco. What are the dates on that?
Well, I believe it's August. I should have it in front of me. I believe it's the weekend of August 8th and 9th, but it's for sure that weekend.
Yeah.
Whatever that Saturday
right.
and Sunday is. And it starts at 9 a.m., and I'll be presenting 3 hours in the morning and three and a half hours in every afternoon. It'll end at 6 both Saturday and Sunday. And we have, I don't know, 120 people, something like that, signed up right now. But we have room for up to 200. So we are encouraging people to come. I've worked with groups up to 400. The process with larger numbers just gets more and more powerful. So I love having the big groups.
Great. And I know you also have the event with Ken Wilber and Bernie Glassman, Roshi, Enlightenment in the Western Mind in Denver, August 29th and 30th. So.
Yeah.
All right.
And the San Francisco is at the Hotel Nico. And the
right.
one in
well,
Denver
for-
is, I believe is the West End in Westminster, where we've done a lot of integral work.
Okay. And anybody who wants information on either of these events, you can go to bigmind.org and find out all about it. And so thank you very much, Roshi. Really appreciate having you.
Thanks, Craig. I really enjoyed it. And all the listeners, thank you.
Great. Okay, well, before I tell you all about what's coming up next, just a few reminders. If you're interested in diving deeper into the conversation, check out our Facebook group, where you can participate in discussion forums on any of the topics we discussed today. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/integralspirit. That's Integral Spirit. And if you have any friends you think might be interested in this series, you can forward them one of the emails that we've sent you so they can figure out how to join us. And if someone sent you this audio, or you found it in some far-flung corner of the internet and you'd like to find out more about what we're doing and listen to the other 14 dialogues in this series, just visit greatintegralawakening.com. That's greatintegralawakening.com. And finally, I want to thank all the sponsors who've made all this possible, including Now and Zen, makers of the Zen Alarm Clock, iEvolve Global Practice Community, The Shift Movie, The New Feminine Power, Ursa Minor Arts and Media, who did the website for the series and also for Integral Enlightenment, did a really nice job. Also, Enlighten Next, Next Step Integral, and Big Mind. And, of course, our two co-hosts, Integral Life and Integral Enlightenment. So join us next week at the same time for Awakening to the Call of the Cosmos, How to Align Your Life with the Impulse of Evolution, featuring me. Yes, next week it's my turn to share my thoughts on all this. So far I've been trying to do as best I can to hold the space for my colleagues and friends to share their insights. And next week I'm going to share my own take on all of these questions. And specifically, I'm going to share my thoughts on why it is that most spiritual teachings and practices rarely deliver on the promise of authentic spiritual awakening. And I'm going to talk about the evolutionary approach to spiritual practice that I call Integral Enlightenment, and how you can ignite your spiritual passion by aligning your life with the evolutionary impulse at the heart of the cosmos. So I hope to see you there. We'll send you an event description and access codes for that event later this week. Until then, thanks for joining us and keep evolving. And now I'll unmute the lines so we can all say goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. 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 Bye.